It's not hard, but it's definitely different. This is, what lesson is this?
Lesson three.
Okay, so we're on lesson three of Esther. Next week is the last lesson of Esther, and then we move into Jonah. So we have really zipped through Esther. If I teach Esther again, we will slow it down because there's way too much. But I want to make sure that, you know, I really struggled with, I went too fast last week and I threw in so much stuff. I want to slow it down, and this is how we're going to slow it down. We're actually going to enter into the story ourselves so that there's going to be very little note-taking today. You can take some, but I've written most of it down for you because I really want us to enter the story so that we get the feel for what's going on. And I think as we do that, and I ask you these questions, you'll begin to understand really what the author of Esther is trying to do, telling the story the way he tells it. So what we're going to do is I want you to get out your observation worksheets of Esther 5, 6, and 7. And I'm going to assign, are only two people sitting here?
Just
you and Diane. Okay. So, Robin, Diane, Jen, you here. I'm assigning you Esther. Okay, so you.
She's our girl.
Take the role of Esther. We're going to sit. Yolanda, you sit either here or here.
All right.
You're Esther with us.
So there's four. I want you guys to take the role of Haman. Okay, so you're the three of you are Haman. So think through who Haman is. The back row.
Not a happy ending.
You are the king. So I want you to take the role of king. The front row, you are Mordecai. And the back row, you're the Jews. The rest of the Jews. So now what I want you to do, we're going to actually read through all three chapters. And I want you to be thinking of who you are, what you're thinking about as you're going through this. And what we'll do is we'll stop at the end of every paragraph after reading it, and I'll ask you the same questions, which are on the top of your very first sheet, or your second sheet. What are you thinking? What do you know? So this is a big question to ask. What do you know? After this first reading, what do you know? What are you thinking? What do you not know? So there are some things I want you to think about because we know the whole story. We kind of gestalt everything into one. But I want you to think about the fact that each of these characters know something and there's something they don't know. And so they have to make their decisions based on what they know and what they don't know. Does this make...
Yeah.
See, I'm going to use that again. Do you understand what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Okay. So what we're going to do is I want the people, the Jews in the back, I want you to be our narrators. So you can choose every paragraph. You can be a different narrator. So I want you to read it. And when it comes to a quote, so if it's a quote by the king or Esther, the king or Esther has to say that. Does that make sense? So if we're reading, there's no quotes in the first. Oh, yeah, there is quotes. So the king will say something in verse 3. So the narrator says, then the king said to her, and one of you is the king, so decide which one of you who wants to speak, say that. Okay? So we're actually role-playing a little bit here. So if there's a quote for Esther, so the people have nothing to say. Mordecai has nothing to say, but the people of Mordecai are still involved in this situation, and there are things they both know and don't know. So at the end of the paragraphs, I'll ask everyone, what do you know? What do you don't know? What are you thinking? Does everyone know what we're doing?
Yes.
Okay.
Who's
so
Esther?
Decide who's going to be the speaker for Esther and for Haman and for the king.
Oh, so
Okay.
Okay, you have
Esther.
Everybody know?
Okay. Shouldn't take that long, girls. Ready? Narrator? Okay, and one other thing. Remember that most of the class is going to be you talking. So, and there's a lot of people absent today. There's going to be a lot of people listening online, which means you must speak very loudly. Okay? You're on stage here. So hopefully you'll be able to pick up. I'm sorry for those people who are listening. There you go. So, you ready?
I'm the first reader.
All right.
I don't have a loud voice. Now, it came about on the third day that Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace in front of the king's rooms, and the king was sitting on his royal throne in the throne room opposite the entrance to the palace. And it happened when the king saw Esther the queen standing in the court, she obtained favor in his sight. And the king extended to Esther the golden scepter which was in his hand. So Esther came near and touched the top of the scepter. Then the king said to her,
"What is troubling you, Queen Esther, and what is your request? Even to half of the kingdom it shall be given to you."
And Esther said,
"If it pleases the king, may the king and Haman come this day to the banquet that I have prepared for him."
Okay, so question here. I'm going to talk about each verse, and then I'm going to ask you the question. So it says, "Now it came about on the third day." I'm going to save that for next week, because there is something there I want to talk about. But that Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court. So what we have here is for the first time, Esther is actually acting in her role as queen. Mm-hmm. Up until this time, it's always Esther. Now it's queen, right? She's putting on her royal robes. So there's an indication here that Esther has now begun to identify with her authority as queen. She understands that she has authority that can actually affect other people. And she also understands that it could be a risk to her. And we have the queen recognizing her as what? The king, recognizing her. What does he recognize Esther as?
The queen.
The queen. He now says, Queen Esther. So it's really important that you look at the words and see the change in words. All of a sudden, now you're going to see queen all over the place. That both the king and queen are recognizing her position and her authority. The king extends his scepter. What do you think that is all about?
Sharing of power.
Sharing of power, but...
Permission.
Permission, yeah. And what would we call it in Christian terms?
Microphone? I don't know.
So remember that what happens to somebody who comes to the king on bid? Yeah.
So grace, I guess.
Grace. Okay. So that's an extension of grace. The king does not have to do that because he should just say, "Off with your head." So it's grace, right? What is it that she touches the scepter? Yeah, not only does she accept the grace, but she recognizes that she needs grace to come in. And then she touches it and accepts the grace that he offers to her. When she does that, when she obtains his favor, she's also recognizing that although she has authority, she's not the top authority. There's an authority over her. So it's this great play of Esther. She's beginning to grow in her understanding of what it is to have authority, but to have divine authority, have right authority. Yes, I have authority, but there's always one that is higher than me. And I need his grace to be able to come in, and I want to have his grace to be able to use my authority. So do you see this very subtle change for Esther of what's happening with her understanding of right authority? So she always obeyed Mordecai, but she never thought about it as grace. Now she actually has authority over Mordecai, but she realizes she can't use that without the grace of the king. So there's this beautiful switch here that we see with Esther. So what does Esther, what do you know? What do you know about the situation? What do you know is going on?
I know that Haman has created law that is going to kill all of my people.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And do you know anything else?
And I know it's because Mordecai refused to bow to him.
Okay.
There's a window of time.
And there's a window of time. You know, you have almost a year. Mm-hmm. Anything else?
And she's, we already said it, but she's risking her life to go before the king.
Yep.
And she's revealing her true identity, which was not, up to this point, unbeknownst to Xerxes.
Yep. But not yet, right? She hasn't done it yet.
But she knows that's what
right.
is going to come with.
Right.
Come
right forward. Okay. Mm-hmm. Anything she doesn't know?
How he'll roll off.
Esther, anything you don't know?
She didn't know if the outcome accepted or not.
You're right. The outcome. Yeah. She doesn't know that the king is going to accept or not, right? She
right.
doesn't know.
She doesn't know if she's going to be losing her head
right.
or
exactly.
be supported.
Exactly. So, I mean, we go back to Meshach and Abednego going into the fire, right? Mm-hmm. They're going to obey God no matter what. We know he has the power to rescue, but even if he doesn't rescue us, he's still God. He's still my authority. So that's where Esther is right now. King, what do you know?
We know that something's bothering her.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yep.
He's pleased to see her.
Okay. So tell me, what do you know then that makes you pleased to see her?
He will give her even up to half of this kingdom.
Yeah, that's his response. Why would he be willing to do that to Esther?
Is he starting to see, or he's starting to see that she's accepting the authority and grace that he's extending?
Okay, and what has she done in the past? What does he know about her in the past, as far as he's concerned?
Pushed him away.
No, she's always pleased him.
Yeah,
but she
how?
She had not seen him for like a month or so.
Right,
so.
Right. But so far, what the king knows about Esther is that she's pretty much stayed in her authority, right? Mm-hmm. Remember, he had a queen that didn't, and now he has a queen that does. Okay, so that's what he knows. What does he not know?
History. Who she is. She's a Jew.
Okay.
Yeah.
He doesn't know that she's a Jew. Anything else?
Why she's there.
Why she's there, right. Mm-hmm. Okay. People. What do you know?
Us people, the Jews?
Mm-hmm.
We're going to die.
You're going to die. Okay. So, do you know that?
I don't really know that yet.
What do you know?
There's an edict.
You know that there's an edict. Mm-hmm. That there is a law that says you're going to get killed in 11 months. Right? So, you do know that, right? Mm-hmm. Think about that, okay? Because what was Karen's answer? We know we're going to die. What do we really know? We know there's an edict that says we're going to die. Is there a difference?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so you got to think about that. Mordecai, what do you know? Oh, I'm sorry. Wait, hang on. People, what do you not know about the situation that's going on? Anything specific?
Like, we don't know about Esther, do we?
Right, no. How would you know? You don't know that Esther's going into the king, do you?
No.
No, you have no idea. You know there's an edict out for your death. You know that in 11 months it's very likely.
But okay. She didn't go into the king until the Jews had prayed or had fasted for her for 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
So that they've been fasting for 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
So that they know that something's going on.
They know something's going on, but they don't know. All she's asked is to pray for me, right? They don't know what's going on. Mordecai, what do you know?
We know that Esther requested everyone to fast.
Okay. Anything else?
Well, I think that you know that she's going to appear before the king. She is going to say something.
So, do you know that?
you know that God is going to not allow all the Jews to be wiped out.
Okay, that's a question, right?
Well, we don't know
for sure. Mm-mm. We don't know for sure.
Well, he expresses that in this first, you know, if you don't do it, it'll happen from somewhere else.
Right, so he definitely believes that in some way the Jews are going to be saved because he knows
that God is going to provide.
God's going to provide. He doesn't know what that means. Looks like, right? Okay.
Okay, I wasn't here last week, but who said that?
Mordecai. Yeah.
Mordecai.
So that's your verse, right?
Right. That's it.
Okay. Did I ask everybody? I didn't ask you guys, right? Haman. What do you know? Right up to this point, what do you know?
Been invited to a banquet?
Not yet.
Oh,
nope.
Sorry.
I'm a buddy with the king.
Okay, yeah. Right.
Just been increased in his authority.
Yep, yep.
And I have to wait 11 months before I can kill the Jews.
Good. Mm-hmm. Okay. What do you not know?
I don't know that Esther's going to bat for the Jews.
Right, mm-hmm. Okay.
Don't know that Esther is a Jew.
Right?
Would
you
know that?
That's
well, no. He didn't know that her and Mordecai were related?
Doesn't look like it.
She never said it.
Think about
it.
Well,
she asked not to say.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
That's an interesting question.
He really kept a close eye on
it. But when we get to the end, you'll realize he couldn't have known. Okay. He couldn't have known that she was Jewish. So I'm doing this. We need to parse this out because we tend to think, because we know everything, all the characters know everything. So let's think through that. All right, let's go on. Start in verse 5.
Then the king said, "Bring Haman quickly, that we may do as Esther desires." So the king and Haman came to the banquet which Esther had prepared. As they drank their wine at the banquet, the king said to Esther, "What is your petition? For it shall be granted to you. And what is your request? Even to half of the kingdom it shall be done." So Esther replied, "My petition and my request is, if I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it pleases the king to grant my petition and do what I request, may the king and Haman come to the banquet which I will prepare for them, and tomorrow I will do as the king says."
Okay. That phrase that the king uses... Let's talk about 5 first. The king wants to do what Esther desires, right?
Mm-hmm.
He wants to give her wishes. I don't want to answer too much, but I want to get to that point. Let me ask you this. Esther has asked whom to come to the banquet?
Haman and the king.
Okay, but who has she asked?
The king.
The king. Has she asked Haman?
Nope.
No. Who asks Haman?
The king.
Okay, what does that say about Esther's knowledge of using authority?
It has to go through the king.
Okay, so it has to go through the king. So she's not asking any favor, right, from her enemy. She's allowing the king to make sure that he gets there, right? What she understands is she has authority, but not full authority. But she does have a lot of, because of how she has said to the king, "You're the authority," she is able to ask the king to ask Haman. So her authority to have anything over her enemy doesn't come from her action. Do you see that?
Yeah, so she is not coming from that internal place of ego to go to Haman and be like,
exactly.
"Ha ha."
Exactly.
I be
you see that little
she
subtlety
need
there?
That.
Right. So
be
she
okay with just deferring.
She
yes.
is God, I'm going to give this to you. Yes. I would like this is what you've put on my heart to do. I'll do this. You know, make sure that to the king, she goes to the king for that.
So she kind of steps over. Like I would say, her authority in this is very much not authority. She she allows the authority of the land to the king, mm-hmm. and she allows the true divine authority to God. She is just,
and yet she takes action, right?
She takes action, but she is a vessel for that.
Right, right, and that's another one of those subtleties. Is she knows she's a vessel here. She's not trying to make her own plan to make sure it works out. If it's not God's plan, then her asking the king, and she's bowing to the king, and the king says, "No, I don't want Haman at the banquet." Then, what? From what we're seeing growing Esther, Esther's going to be okay with that. Do you see that?
As well as she'll be okay with it if he says off with your head.
Right, right.
She's given
herself to whatever the king has to say. All right.
With one exception, though, she hasn't told him who she is.
Right, but yes. she's gonna do that, right? We know that. So we have Haman coming because the king tells him to. We have her being asked, "What is your petition? And what is your request?" So there's two things in here. What is your petition? What is your request? How many things is he telling Esther she can have? How many requests can she have?
Two, basically.
Really?
One request and one petition.
What do you think when he says that?
I think it's one.
What is your
It's really just one. What he's saying is, I so want to grant you whatever you wish. But he's not saying, you have two wishes. Tell me what you want, mm-hmm. what one thing you want. And that will play in a minute. And then, of course, he has this, even to half of the kingdom it shall be done. Have you heard that anywhere else?
Saul said it to David.
Herod.
John the Baptist.
Yep. To Herodias. Herod said it to Herodias, mm-hmm. if you think about that. In Daniel, the king says it. Nebuchadnezzar says it. So it is a kingly way of saying, I want to show you how generous I am. Mm-hmm. Whatever you want. It's not a literal. We're so literal sometimes that we think that this is what they're saying. They're not saying, I'm giving you half of the kingdom. They're saying, I'm so generous. I would love to give you your request. Okay, so we have Esther saying that she's going to tell them on the next day. This is an interesting piece here. One of the things you need to understand is she's being very careful here. She's taking her time and making sure that the king understands that he is being honored. That the king is being honored. The king needs to know that because what she's going to say, mm-hmm. finally. Why do you think? When she finally is going to tell him what she wants and what the problem is, why do you think she needs to be careful that the king knows that she honors him? Okay, Haman's his right hand man.
So she's telling him that he's a traitor or whatever. He's going to kill half the people.
Okay, so you're getting to the point.
She also kind of wants him to change this edict, and that's something that's not to be done.
Okay.
He can trust her.
Go back to where Karen's talking about. There's some connection here between Haman and the king, right?
Well,
what's
the
connection?
The king made him the right hand man.
Yes.
It was his choice.
But what else did the king do?
Gave him his ring.
Let's think about the edict.
Kind of bribe.
Haman.
Who made the edict?
Haman.
Really?
But the king signed it.
The king made the edict. Remember? So what does Esther need to make sure she is not doing?
She can't be. She needs the king.
Right. She can't indict the king.
No. She needs him to know that she is with him regardless of what his decision is.
Okay. So this is why she's being very careful to make sure that the king knows he's being honored. That she doesn't, in the long run, blame him for this. Okay? So that's what's going on with this. Let's have a second banquet. You know, I want to make sure you know you're honored. All right, go on. 9.
Then Haman went out that day, glad and pleased with heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gates, and that he did not stand up or tremble before him, Haman was filled with anger against Mordecai. Haman
Haman controlled himself, however, went to his house and sent for his friends and his wife, Zeresh. Then Haman recounted to them the glory of his riches and the number of his sons, and every instance where the king had magnified him, and how he had promoted him above the princes and servants of the king. Haman also said,
"Even Esther the queen, let no one but me come with the king to the banquet which she had prepared. And tomorrow also I am invited by her with the king. Yet all of this does not satisfy me every time I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate."
Then Zeresh his wife and all his friends said to him,
one of you guys, Zeresh.
"Have a gallows 50 cubits high made, and in the morning ask the king to have Mordecai hanged on it. Then go joyfully with the king to the banquet."
And the advice pleased Haman, so he had the gallows made.
Okay.
Dun, dun, dun.
such drama here. And you're right, it would make a really good show. All right, so we know Haman goes out, and he's very glad and pleased of heart. What do you think that really means?
He is so proud.
Yeah. He is like,
he thinks he has really good system.
Yeah. Right. See, the way I'm using my authority, that's the way to go. I'm so successful. Like, to him, it's just confirming that redefining authority is a good thing. So we have to remember that every time we see Haman, it's a picture of redefined authority. And he is saying, look, life bears out that redefined authority is great. Being your own authority, deciding what's good and evil for yourself is good. It works out. It makes you successful and have a lot of respect and rich. It makes you everything. So that's how we see Haman here. But of course, then we see Haman, and all he does is pass Mordecai. And what happens?
All worked up.
Now he's all worked up. I'm so proud. I'm so good. Oh. What is Haman always being controlled by?
Jealousy, ego,
what he can't have.
Yeah. So, really and truly, his circumstances always bring up his emotions, and that's what drives him. So what drives him in his decisions are his circumstances that bring his emotions to the surface.
But there's also a bit where they talk about the fact that he knew the prophecies are very important to these people, and he knew that the prophecy said that his people were not long for the haul, right? They were not gonna, the prophecy did not state that he and his people were gonna rise. So I also think it is just this real absolute narcissism that makes him believe that he really thinks that he has the power to overrule the prophecy.
That's exactly right. That's what redefined authority always does. Redefined authority says, I'm really the top authority, so a prophecy is under me. I can change it. I can make sure that my life turns out the way I want it to. That's redefined authority. And that's exactly what Haman's doing. Exactly. I know that I have the ability to make my life good. And yet, really, the interesting thing about that is when we redefine authority, we actually don't even have authority over our own selves. Because what's ruling him? His own emotions. Mm-hmm. Are ruling him. His circumstances, he turns and sees Mordecai, and all of a sudden he's just all upset. And now that's going to direct what he does. Isn't that interesting? That redefined authority thinks they have the authority over everything, including prophecy, including any divine, and yet they're actually ruled by their very base emotions.
Reminds me of the toddler.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
That's my toy.
Right, exactly.
I'll do it.
So that's what we have with Haman here. It's so interesting. But then, of course, it says that Haman controls himself, which is very interesting that he has enough control to go, I'm going to do something about this, but I'm not going to let my emotion trigger me now. I'm going to make sure that my emotion gets a hold of a good plan, a big plan. So he goes and is interesting. So he decides he needs some advice. And yet, he can't just go and say, I am in a quandary. What do I do? What does he do? What's the first thing he does when he goes to look for advice?
Boasts.
He boasts. By the way, guys, I'm looking for advice, but just so you know.
I'm super amazing.
I'm super amazing. I am rich. I have prestige. I have respect. Just so you know, I'm much better than you. What do you think? So that's what Haman's doing, right? He wants to make sure. So Redefined Authority always does this. Redefined Authority always wants to make sure that you know that I'm in charge. Even when they really need help. So they can't ask for real help. They can't say, I don't know what to do. I'm in a mess. They have to say, I am great at this. Hey, what do you think? So that there's always this striving, and this is why even the verse, be still, stop striving and know that I am God. With Redefined Authority, there's always a striving to make sure that you know you're in charge, that you know that you have control of things.
And also to followers. I mean, basically what you're saying is,
right.
I do not need any of you, but feel free to let me know that you're there with me.
Right, right, exactly, exactly.
And they're like, really looking for advice. He's really just looking for someone to pat him on the back. So it doesn't matter who it comes from. He's not looking for wise people. He's just looking for people.
Right, exactly, exactly. To affirm his emotions, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right,
yeah.
So, and of course, he even mentions that Esther thinks that he is wonderful. And then he says, yet all of this does not satisfy me. I mean, he says it right there. Power never satisfies. Redefined authority never satisfies. I will always be dissatisfied with something because some circumstance will come up where I am nervous about getting control of it. And that's almost a red flag for us. When we have a circumstance that comes up that like we got to control this. We can't let this happen. That tells you right there, you're working on redefined authority. And we all have that. We all come up with that. But that's what's happening with Haman here. And then, of course, Zeresh and his friends all tell him, yeah, Haman, you're right. You should be led by your emotions. Let's do what an emotional response would be. So it's not even a response, it's a reaction, right? And they're affirming some kind of reaction. And the solution here is to have a gallows built 50 cubits high. So she told you, I think, that it's that means 75 feet high, right? And just so you know what a gallows is, because I know all your what are you all picturing?
A noose.
A hang noosey. Not true. a gallows is actually a sharpened pole.
Wait, what?
That's what a gallows is.
Like a
spear. Like a cloth. Yep, that's what it is.
How'd you get somebody on the top of that pole?
Yeah.
With
yeah.
A lot of
well, just like they did with a cross, right? Put it on the ground and then hoist it up.
Oh, sweet Lord.
So that's what a gallows is. So you are hanging there.
Yeah.
And that was used a lot. In actuality, Saul and Jonathan were put on one of these at the wall of Beth-Shean.
That makes more sense, because at the end, he said he was killed, and then they were hanged on the gallows. It's like, but I thought they were killed.
So right. So, we don't even know how he was killed. Could have been any way. The hanging on the gallows wasn't particularly the execution means. It was a statement. Okay? Yeah. So, when you think of cross, when you go into the New Testament, kind of the same thing, the Romans just put it together. It's a statement. It's a statement against the enemy. I have authority over you. So it's an authoritarian statement. That's what they're having him do. And 75 feet is really high. That's like 10 times higher than the ceiling here. That's really high, really big.
Everyone,
yep. And it's about Haman. Look. I am the authority here. And so, of course, then we have Haman go to the bank. So,
can I just
ask
a question? Would Haman have the authority to kill Mordecai like that without the king's permission?
That's an interesting question. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. I don't know about that. I think as we get to the end, you'll see the king is a little smarter than we think.
Well, Haman, up to now, what he's seen is that all of the king's people have been making laws left and right. I mean, after Vashti, and they made that law, and then with this one, he's feeling rolling pretty right now.
Yeah. My guess is no.
He has more authority, maybe, than the king.
Well, verse 14 says,
yes.
Verse 14, they tell him to ask the king to have Mordecai hang.
Oh. Right, right. So he knows he doesn't, and yet he's assuming that he's going to get it. Right.
He says ask, but then he goes ahead and gets the gigantic sword.
Right, exactly. And right. And that again is that idea that I assume that I'm going to be able to do anything I want to do.
Well, doesn't Mordecai fall into the category of Jews? So this is just, he's asking this to happen earlier.
Right.
So, okay.
Earlier, and in a way that exalts Haman and shows off that his enemies will not get away with it. Okay. So, Esther, what do you know at this point?
I know I'm getting ready to let out a major secret. And that I'm going to make good on the divine authority and speak truth.
I can't imagine just even having to sit across from Haman at this banquet. You know, just all...
Do you know anything that Haman's done? I mean, do you know about this? Gallows? If you're Esther?
No.
No.
You don't know right?
No.
Not yet.
You don't know.
But you do know that there's a big problem between Haman and her father.
Sure. But right now, you don't know that Haman is ready to kill Mordecai, right?
No. But you know that he's come up with the edict and...
Yep.
He's
right. Snaggy.
Yep. Okay.
She probably knows he's a head, doesn't she? Because he's called that.
You know, that's a good question. I would guess yes, but we don't know. But I would guess yes. I'm kind of forgetting. Are you guys the king? Mm-hmm. What does the king know?
He doesn't know that Mordecai has already put this plan in place.
Right. So he doesn't know.
He knows he's coming to another banquet.
He doesn't know what the
banquet's about.
He doesn't know what the banquet's
about.
Doesn't
know
what
Esther wants.
Okay. Mordecai, what do you know or not know?
He doesn't know if Esther has gone before the king or not.
Right. What do you not know?
He probably doesn't know about the banquets that she's having with the king and Haman.
Mm-hmm. Do you think he knows about the gallows?
I can probably see it. I think it's 75 feet high.
Yep, so he probably sees it.
But he might not know it's for him.
Doesn't know what for him.
When, because the edict says.
Right. But he knows something's going on, right? Mm-hmm. He also knows that Haman walked past him. Mm-hmm. And regardless of the fact that he controlled himself, what do you think? Body language? Yeah. So Mordecai might have some inkling, right? That something's going on. It might have to do with me. Those gallows might have to do with me. Possible. I think it's interesting that it's very possible Mordecai knows what's going on, but Mordecai is doing no more directing of Esther. So what it kind of tells you is there's a possibility that Mordecai is more concerned about the people than about himself.
Probably Esther too. Like if he's in there too much, it might reveal something.
Yep, exactly. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's go on to 6. Loudly, please. It's 7. So do you see where it's bold?
Oh, I love it. Sometimes hard to see.
It is sometimes hard to see, I agree. So just 6, 1 through 7.
Okay. During the night, the king could not sleep, so he gave an order to bring the book of records, the Chronicles, and they were read before the king. It was found written what Mordecai had reported concerning Bignatha and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs, who were doorkeepers, that they had sought to lay hands on King...
Just say Xerxes. Yeah.
The king said, what honor or dignity has been...
The king
said... Oh, I'm sorry. The king said, sorry, my eyes are not great today.
What honor or dignity has been bestowed on Mordecai for this?
Then the king's servants who attended him said,
nothing has been done for him.
So the king said,
who is in the court?
Okay, now Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace in order to speak to the king about hanging Mordecai on the gallows, which he had prepared for him. The king's servant said to him,
somebody from the king's court.
Behold, Haman is standing in the court.
And the king said,
let him come in.
So Haman came in, and the king said to him,
what is to be done for the man whom the king desires to honor?
And Haman said to himself,
whom would the king desire to honor more than me?
Go through seven here. Okay, then Haman said to the king,
For the man whom the king desires to honor,
finish up.
Let them bring a royal robe, which the king has worn, and the horse on which the king has ridden, and on whose head a royal crown has been placed.
Keep going.
And let the robe and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble princes, and let them array the man whom the king desires to honor, and lead him on horseback through the city square, and proclaim before him, thus it shall be done to the man whom the king desires to honor.
Okay. Great, right? This is just this part. Great reversal. And there is a nice Greek word for that. It's called periphery. We have this huge reversal of fortune here that is just beginning to show. So, during the night, the king could not sleep. Coincidence?
I think not.
And so we have him finding that Mordecai was the one who not only stopped the assassins by his report, but that he had not honored him. Now, what position is Xerxes in right now? He's vulnerable. Why is he vulnerable? Right. So it's very possible that lots of people are after his throne, right? Which means if he hasn't honored someone who has helped him,
it's a bad situation.
Ooh, what's he thinking?
He's going to get it.
Either he's going to get it or I better do something about this now, right? Mm-hmm. I got to keep my friends close. I've got to make sure that I honor not only his position, but as a king, this was very... So kings I think kings all the time have always been very transactional. Mm-hmm. You're a king because of some transaction, right? You've gotten to be a king because of that. So for a king not to honor someone who has done something for him is a huge, huge mistake. So the king is finding that nothing was done for him. So he's like all consumed. I have got to do something for Mordecai. I've got to protect myself, make sure that my friends are my friends. And as king, I must make sure that I am giving to those who are honoring me. So he's consumed by that. It's been 5 years. So he's really like, whoa, I can't believe I haven't done this. I need to do that. So, of course, the king asks, by this time, obviously, if he's read all the chronicles for the last 5 years, it's daytime, it's morning, and he asks, who's in the court? Who's in the court?
Haman.
Coincidence?
No.
Okay. Why is he in the court?
Coming to speak. Ask for a
case. Yeah. Okay, now, let's think about this. Esther needed to ask something of the king, and she knew what? She can't come before the king, right?
Without
being summoned.
Right.
Okay. Now, Haman does have second in command, but rules still apply. Mm-hmm. How does Haman enter?
Saunters on in.
I'm not looking for grace. I deserve to be heard, right? Mm-hmm. Now, the king knows this. But I want you to think about what the king knows. Hang on. Haman's unwilling to wait for his edict to get Mordecai. He wants it out now. But the king asked, who's out in the court? It's Haman. And he says, let Haman come in. How do you think the king actually says that? Let Haman come in. Because now the king knows a lot, right? We'll talk about that in just seconds, what he knows.
But the king knows that Mordecai's the one that led the plan, but he doesn't know so much about Haman's part in hiding it. I mean, right?
Okay, let's I'll ask you that in a few minutes.
At this point.
We know that the king's focus is on honoring Mordecai. Mm-hmm. That's his whole focus. And Haman comes in. So Esther came in to ask for something, as does Haman. What's the king's response to Haman? Is it the same as his response to Esther?
No. Let him come in. The king starts questioning Haman rather than letting Haman ask.
Right, exactly. This tells you the king knows a lot. He's not concerned at all about giving grace to Haman. He's not concerned about asking Haman, what does he want? Right? Jen, what were you going
to
ask?
Well, I was just saying about the golden scepter. Does he not have to get, he's above the scepter?
Well, he's not above the scepter.
Right, he thinks he is.
Which tells you, again, the king knows something here. And the king's playing it out. Okay? The king is now in control of the situation completely.
Okay, why is it telling us that? I don't get it. Because mm-hmm. wouldn't it also just say that the king's so preoccupied about what he's thinking about Mordecai that he's just saying, oh, well, tell me what you would do to honor somebody. Like, why wouldn't...
It could be, except that this is just everyday protocol for him. It's something he does every day. Gives out the scepter or not.
But it also says that he couldn't sleep all night. So he knew something's bothering him. Something is weighing on him if he cannot sleep. So it sounds like based on everything that's happened, this is not someone who is feeling comfortable in his surroundings, that he's starting to realize that he needs to pay closer attention to his surroundings.
Yeah. It's more than the focus. It's more than him not sleeping. He's skipping over protocol, which means there's another plan in action here. Do you understand why, Karen?
Yeah, I mean, I do, but I feel like we're reading into it just a little bit, don't you think?
Well, except that you know what the king does every single day.
Right.
If someone needs to talk to him, he hands out the scepter or not. That's
even
what he does every day.
Even with his right-hand man, even with the guy?
Even with his right-hand man.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, he's not actually pulling a fast one on him. I mean, he's not.
Maybe.
He knows some. We don't know how much he knows.
Okay, let's go on and see.
Okay.
And Haman says, so when the king says, what would you do? And I want you to think about what he knows. We'll ask in a minute. What does the king know? And now he's going to ask Haman. Haman, what would you do to honor someone? Who's the king thinking of?
Mordecai,
right? He's thinking of Mordecai. He knows who Mordecai is. What would you do, Haman? Now, we have Haman. And what's Haman thinking? What is Haman?
Himself.
Of course, because redefined authority is self-deceiving. Always. Redefined authority says, I'm in control. And not only, since I'm in control, it means all the good I get is I'm entitled to. Entitlement for everything good, and anything that happens to me that's not good is unfair. Because if I'm in control and something happens to me that's not good, well, it's not fair. There's this slight understanding of if something bad happens to me, it's because I didn't know about it and someone was unfair. It's not because it was good for me. It's not because somebody else is in control. It's because it's unfair. So Haman is, of course, thinking that it's about him. And so he's going to answer as if it's about him. So what does Haman answer? What should be the honor here? What do we know Haman already has? He's got the signet ring. He just told Zeresh and his family what he has. He's got all the riches. He's got all the honor. What more could he get?
Robe,
the robe and the crown.
The robe and the crown, right?
And
he could
do the city.
Yeah, he could have the obvious top authority. So he still kind of knows there's authority over him, but he's not really. So just give me those visible signs of the top authority that I am so intimate with the king that I am the king. And if you know some stuff under here about covenant, what do you see here? What is he asking?
The king's identity.
He's asking for the king's identity because of the robe, right? Exchange of robes is a covenant exchange of identities. He's asking for the identity of the king. I am the one who should have that. So that's what he's asking for. But it's, I think it's most interesting that he's so self-deceived that he doesn't even ask that it might be about somebody else.
Do you think the king knows that Haman would think it was for himself?
Yep. Yep, I do.
How much does Haman, have a role in hiding Mordecai's the king knowing that Mordecai saved his life?
Okay, we'll get to that. So then he wants not only the robe and the crown, now he wants to be paraded around by the most noble prince, right? What does that say?
That's Haman, right? He thinks he's considered the most noble prince.
Yeah, but he's going to be honored.
Right.
Where in relation to the most noble prince?
Above him.
What he's doing is comparing. I want everyone to know that I am above. I am in comparison. Redefined authority will always compare. They have to, right? Because they have to prove that they are the authority, that they are above. So in all subtle ways, the comparisons we make are part of our redefined authority. I'm better than here, or I want to show that I'm better than in this. It's this subtle way we use redefined authority. And that's what's going on with Haman here. So what do we know? What does the king know? What does Haman know? King, what do you know? You've read the logs, right?
Mordecai saved his life.
You know that Mordecai saved your life.
And nothing's been done to honor him.
What do you know about Haman?
Well, you know Mordecai didn't speak up for himself out of pride to
point
that out.
Good. Mm-hmm. Good. Yep. What do you know about Haman?
He just entered the court.
He built the gallows.
He built the gallows. We don't know yet. Mm-hmm. We might. What do you know about Haman and the edict?
He was involved in the edict. I mean,
he's the one who got him, right? That's a big deal. So he knows that Mordecai saved his life. He knows that Haman wants to kill a people. We don't know yet whether he knows that Mordecai's a Jew or not, right? Mm-hmm. We'll get there.
You start doubting Haman. Why does Haman want to do this, really?
Okay, so we haven't connected that yet, but we will. Haman, what do you know?
What do I believe that I know?
Yeah, what do you believe? You yeah.
That I'm going to be honored.
That you're going to be honored, yes. You definitely believe that. And that's a good question to ask because how we would answer it if we were in the situation is, well, I know I'm going to be honored. I know that I am the friend of the king. I know that I'm great. We wouldn't question that was a belief, right?
And the king is reinforcing that by not showing him the scepter,
right?
And saying you don't fall under these rules,
right? Exactly.
Yeah.
So people don't know anything about this that's going on, right? Do the people know what's going on?
Well, there's a gallows being built.
They know a gallows being built.
They don't know.
So what is where does that tip them on the scales about Karen's comment of we know we're gonna die?
They really
they're like, now they're thinking,
now.
Sooner than later. Whoa, it's going to be in the case. Do they know anything that's going on in the courts?
No.
They don't know about Esther's banquets, right? Mm-hmm. They don't know that Haman is coming in, and they don't know the king had a sleepless night and has read the books about Mordecai. They don't know any of that. What they know is they're still under a death decree, right? Anybody else we need to know? Esther, what does Esther know about what's happening here? Does Esther know about the king having a sleepless night?
No. Probably not.
Probably not. Does she know that he has read the books about Mordecai?
Mm-mm. No.
Does she know that Mordecai was never honored?
Yeah.
Or her?
Yeah, probably.
Because they both had a hand in this. She knows that. But it's been 5 years. It's not in her mind, right? Okay, so let's go on to...
She doesn't know that Haman showed up at the door, either.
She doesn't know that Haman has now showed up at the door before her second banquet, where she's going to... Mm-hmm. She doesn't know that. She knows what she wants to say, but she doesn't know that Haman is, in effect, hanging himself. Right? Okay, verse 10. Go ahead.
Then the king said to Haman,
"Take quickly the robes and the horse, as you have said, and do so for Mordecai the Jew, who is sitting at the king's gate. Do not fall short in anything of all that you have said."
So Haman took the robe and the horse and arrayed Mordecai and led him on horseback throughout the city square and proclaimed before him,
"Thus it shall be done to the man whom the king deserves to honor."
Then Mordecai returned to the king's gate, but Haman hurried home, mourning, with his head covered. Haman recounted to Zeresh, his wife, and all his friends everything that had happened to him. Then his wise men and Zeresh, his wife, said to him,
"That's you guys.
Oh, us? Mm-hmm. If Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of Jewish origin, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him."
While they were still talking to him, the king's eunuchs arrived and hastily brought Haman to the banquet, which Esther had prepared.
So many interesting things in just a short little thing. Okay, so we have the king, of course, turn the tables on Mordecai and Haman. But he says something very revealing here.
He says the Jew. Mordecai.
Yeah.
He knew.
So you now go back to that beginning when Haman walks in.
Yeah.
What does he know? He knows Mordecai's a Jew, mm-hmm. and he knows Haman. Now, Haman never revealed that it was Jews, right? But does the king know it's Jews that he wants to go after? Think about what's happened in the past. What have Mordecai and all the Jews been doing?
Morning.
Publicly.
Yeah.
They're out there. The king knows that it's the Jews.
Okay.
Do you understand
Jews,
that?
Yes, because the Jews have been out mourning, so
yep.
he knows it's them.
Right. So now he knows that it's the Jews that are mourning over the edict. He knows that it's the Jews that Haman has declared to be killed, are the ones under sentence. He knows that.
So he must know that his wife's been fasting as well.
No.
Was she not fasting?
No, she was fasting. He does not know that because she's in the harem.
She's making banquets now.
And she's making banquets. Yeah, the fast is over. So he knows this. And he knows Mordecai the Jew is whom to him now?
Savior.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he knows Haman is what?
Enemy. Someone who's after his job.
Yeah. So think about this. Haman is the one behind the plot to kill the Jews, specifically Mordecai, who was the savior of the king. What does that make Haman? Yeah. Complete enemy, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is what the king knows when Haman walks in the door. So now was the king playing Haman?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. That's what the king was doing. He knows exactly. He knows who Haman is. He knows Haman's going to think this, and he wants Haman to hang himself for a couple reasons. We'll look at that in a second. So he makes Haman parade Mordecai around, do exactly the opposite of what he had planned, right? He wanted to parade Mordecai on the gallows, and now he's parading him around as the king. That's what he's doing. He's showing him as the king around.
So do you think the king all along knew Mordecai was a Jew, or he was reminded that he was a Jew when he pulled out the chronicles?
I think that's a good question, I'm actually apt to think he all along knew. And that he's allowing Haman to play out. I think so. I don't know, though.
Okay.
We know for sure that he knows at this point.
Well, let me ask you this. So he originally said, yes, you can get rid of the Jews, right?
The people that are rebellious, right?
The people.
Right.
But then now, so but then he knew it was the Jewish people.
And well, we don't know.
Well, because you said they
well,
were
that was in the
Edict.
It was written in the Edict that the Jews were to be killed.
The people who were rebellious.
He knew who were rebellious. So he didn't know at the time of the edict, but he knew.
We don't know.
Once he saw because of the
put it together after the fact.
Right. And remember, the king told him that he could have that, but who signed the edict with the ring?
Haman.
Haman actually did, because Haman got the ring. So he didn't have to see the words.
Haman saying, because I don't think, did Haman know that Mordecai was the savior, that he had saved the king?
Probably not.
So he's holding that against them, though. Like it seems like it's a very, pretty big decision for the king to like go against Haman,
mm-hmm.
just because now Mordecai was had saved him.
Well, let's think about this. The king knows that there are plots out there, right?
Right.
And Haman is his second in command.
Right.
One of the positions Haman would have would be to protect him, right? Mm-hmm. Know who's out there helping and hurting him. So it's part of his job to know some of that.
Well, he's mad now that he probably did know that he saved him and hasn't done, helped him do anything.
Yeah.
So when they said he couldn't sleep at night, that makes sense that his mind was, he knew there were plots, and he decided to have them read the chronicle. Like it almost to me was like, I know something's going on. I need to go back and revisit everything
okay.
here.
This is interesting because we'll get to this point because you just said it makes sense now that Haman.
Oh
sleeping.
Man, I used those words.
And that's interesting because we want it to make sense, but we'll see how he's how the author structured it to know what's happening here. All right, so we have Mordecai. Interesting that Mordecai gets paraded around as the king, and then what does he do afterwards?
He's back to the gate.
He's back to work. He goes back and does his job. Isn't that interesting?
Mm-hmm.
Would Haman have done that?
No.
Yeah. And then what does Haman do? Okay, he mourns. So now this what's happening here, and I'll show you in structure in a minute, is we're getting the opposite reflection of what was happening with the Jews, right? When the Jews were under some kind of an edict, they mourned. But what did they do in their mourning? Sackcloth and ashes. They exposed themselves. They said, we're nothing. We're only dust. What does Haman do?
He hides under his hood.
He covers and hides. He runs home. So it's the opposite. I'm not exposing myself. I'm not going to let everybody know that I'm without help except from someone else. He's hiding, right? Does it remind you? I mean, whenever you see this, you always have to think, Scripture is always talking about Scripture. When he covers his head and hides, what do you think?
Adam and Eve.
Mm-hmm. So you're right back to, and what was Adam and Eve's sin? But redefined authority.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's what you're seeing here in these beautiful pictures. I think Esther is probably one of the most amazingly written. On the surface, it just looks like a good story. And then you go into it and you think, oh, I know exactly what's going on here. And so, So Mordecai returns to the gate. He hurries home. And he goes, I love this. Haman goes to Zeresh and all his friends and tells them what's happened. And what do they say to him?
Oh, you're in trouble.
Yeah. But I want you to think about this.
They realized that.
It was their idea.
Jewish thing.
It was their idea, right? They were saying, yeah, you do it. You go. You make. And now they're going, oh, he's a Jew. You shouldn't have done that. What's happening here?
Totally losing it.
Disconnected from
him. Why?
Because he's an enemy. He's going to die.
He's going to die.
Yeah.
Redefined authority has no loyal friends.
Mm.
Because the friends they have, if it's redefined authority, are friends they got by transaction.
Yeah.
And transaction all of a sudden is gone. He has nothing to give them. So they're like, step away. You're in trouble.
But would they have also
they
been...
Him. They usually kill family.
Right, exactly. And that's it. They're going, you have nothing on us. I mean, there is no loyalty here whatsoever. Zeresh is like, oh, that was stupid. He's Jewish.
And I called Wiseman now, too.
Yes. Isn't that interesting? Yes. So interesting.
The majority of them would probably be of the same tribe as him, so they would know that their demise is not too far ahead if the prophecy falls in.
But remember, and this will answer one of those questions I heard you all of you talk about when it comes to looking at that verse, our memory verse, as how it is applied to us when it says, but you and your household shall die. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was some good discussions about, is that literal or not? No, obviously it's not, because none of the verse is literal for us. But die, when you're talking about a non-literal death, what does that mean?
Removed from God?
Yeah, outside of covenant, right? And you and your family means you'll pass on living outside of covenant. Does that make sense? Zeresh is definitely, you know, from his people. But remember, Haman has passed on to his family redefined authority. So they're still in that mode of, we can get life for ourselves. We're our own authority. And that's exactly what they're doing. They're trying to get life for themselves here, right? I'm not going to die with you. Step away. I will not identify with you as long as you can't give me anything. I'll identify you as long as you give me something. There's a transactional idea here of identification. Very different than what we see Esther doing, right? Esther says, we'll get to that in a minute. She talks about her identity with the people. And so we have that happening. He loses not only he's going to lose not only his life, but his friends and family, which he really doesn't have. So now he gets zipped over to the banquet. Chapter 7, let's go. Loudly, please.
Now the king and Haman came to drink wine with Esther the queen, and the king said to Esther on the second day also, as they drank their wine at the banquet,
what is your petition, Queen Esther? It shall be granted you. And what is your request? Even to half of the kingdom shall it be done.
And Queen Esther answered and said,
if I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it pleases the king, let my life be given me as my petition, and my people as my request. For we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. Now, if we had only been sold as slaves, men and women, I would have remained silent, for the trouble would not be commensurate with the annoyance to the king.
Then King Xerxes asked Queen Esther,
who is he, and where is he? Who would you presume to do this?
And Esther said,
a foe and an enemy is this wicked Haman.
Then Haman became terrified before the king and queen. And the king arose in his anger from drinking wine and went into the palace garden. But Haman stayed to beg for his life from Queen Esther, for he saw that harm had been determined against him by the king. Now when the king returned from the palace garden into the place where they were drinking wine, Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was. Then the king said,
will he even assault the queen with me in this house?
As the word went out of the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. Then Harbana, one of the eunuchs who were before the king, said,
what king? King's court.
Oh. Behold, indeed, the gallows standing in Haman's house, 50 cubits high, which Haman made for Mordecai, who spoke good on behalf of the king.
And the king said,
hang him on it.
So they hanged Haman on the gallows which he had prepared for Mordecai, and the king's anger subsided.
Okay. Really great conclusion to this interesting thing. All right, so we have the king and Haman come, and they ask, finally, the king asks Esther, what's your petition and what's your request? And then the queen does this great thing. Remember, it's one request she's getting. But she says, my request is my life, my petition is my people's life, they're one and the same. My people and I are one and the same. She's not asking for two different things here, because she knows she only has one request. But she's saying, my people and I are one people. There can be no separation. There is no such thing as, because think about this. She's the queen, and she could say, could you spare my life? And then if she gets another request, maybe she could ask for the thing. And the king could easily say, and you see this all the time, well, queen, I'm going to spare your life, but I'm not going to spare theirs. But what Esther does is says, my request and my plea is that you save us. We're one. You can't separate the two. So that's that interesting of why you need to know. That's one request and how she puts that. And remember that the question that began Esther was, as a people that are outside of Jerusalem and the temple, what does covenant have to do with this anymore? Is covenant still in effect? What Esther's doing here is saying, I belong to the covenant people. The covenant people are going to say, hold on to the covenant as being what is over us. And I'm in that covenant. I'm a covenant people. It's a huge declaration here about being a covenant member. So she makes sure that the very last thing she says is Haman. So she says she makes it very graphic. We've been sold, we've been destroyed, killed, annihilated. And then she says, if we had only been sold as slaves, I wouldn't even come to you. And what she's telling here is, what is the issue that matters? Is it suffering that matters?
No.
What matters?
Life.
Why is it life that matters for Esther? Why is it life that matters for the Jews?
It's the Messiah.
They know that the Jews are the hope of the world, right? The Jews are the only people who have been made as a people to bring God's presence into the world. They are the only hope. So that it is life for God's covenant people, the only ones that can bring life to all the world, that is worth standing up for. It's not suffering that's worth standing up for. It's life, silence. I mean, she says something about silencing, doesn't she, at some point?
I would have remained silent.
Yes. So it's the complete silencing of the covenant people that she is concerned about. You can't let the covenant people be silenced because they are the word of life for all the world. This is the issue here. And so, of course, we have the king asking Esther who it is, and she identifies him as a foe and an enemy and wicked, and it's Haman. And Haman becomes terrified before the king and queen. Now, the king arises in his anger, and he goes into the palace garden. It's so interesting. We'll talk a little bit more about that next week, but we have him arising from his anger and going out. What's the king doing here? I want you to think about what he's thinking. Okay, he now knows the whole story. He knows that Haman has made the edict, but under his authority, right? He said, yes, let's make this edict. What does the king know? What does he know about the edict? What does he know about Esther's request? What does he know about Esther's indictment, basically?
Well, it's really against the king, because the king made it.
Right.
So maybe he's leaving to get Haman to further, you know, do something wrong. So he can really, that's what
himself.
He's going to, yep. He's really hanging out because he was all over us.
So he's agitated because he knows he is in a quandary, right? Now what am I going to do?
He can't change the edict.
He can't change the edict.
Right.
And he's the one who actually allowed the edict to happen.
Why can't he change the edict? Just because he can't?
Right. Remember, they talked about the very beginning. An edict from a Persian king cannot be changed.
By the king.
Even by the king. It is done.
Well, then what is she asking for that can be changed?
We'll see that.
Yeah. Thank you.
She's asking for her life, right? Okay, so.
There's lots of ways for that to happen.
And that's why we always think there's only one way for things to happen.
So did the edict, I'm trying to remember, did it say Jews or did it just say the enemy of the king?
Well, we don't know exactly what the edict said, but we know that all the Jews are mourning, so they know it's them.
Right.
So, so we have the king in a quandary. He can't change the edict, and he knows if he punishes Haman, that leaves him. So now he doesn't know what to do. So he walks into the garden. Okay, I got to figure this out. What are we going to do? But also, Cindy, you're right. Haman has got to hang himself. Mm-hmm. And of course he does. So we have the king leaving. Now, here's something you don't know and you wouldn't know. But and I'm going to say the Arabic word. This is how they would pronounce it. Harem. Anybody ever heard of the word harem in Arabic?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's harem. Harem is an Arabic word. Harem. Protocol is that no one could be in the presence of one of the harem women alone. So that's harem protocol. In fact, the word harem, if you know it in Arabic, what does it mean? You know?
Oh, we talked about this. It
we have a German word that we say all the time that's the same thing, verboten.
Oh, forbidden.
Forbidden.
Yes.
Harem means forbidden. That's why a harem is called a harem. Forbidden. They're not. No one is allowed to be in the presence of a harem woman alone.
And Xerxes goes to the garden.
What should Haman be doing?
Following
him. He should be following him. That would be the smart thing. He should be leaving. And he doesn't.
Well, who covered Haman's face? There had to be some other.
Well, hang on. They'll come in. But remember, this is a banquet for Haman, and this is just the three of them. The second harem protocol is, if someone is in the room and you are with a harem woman, you can't be closer than 7 steps.
And he fell on the couch.
What's Haman doing? He's using his redefined authority, right? I don't have to follow harem protocol. I don't have to confess. I can plead for my life because it's me who's in charge of getting life for myself.
Yeah.
I can do this. So I'm going to forget about all the harem protocol because I'm Haman. And I'll fall on Esther's couch.
So is he falling on Esther's couch with the intent of pleading for his life? Or like, is he so bad at her that he's...
No, pleading for his life. It's all about him right now, okay?
He's going around.
It says assault.
He's going around what?
He's going around the king.
He's going around the king. Exactly. So he's doing everything wrong in as far as protocol goes, but he's Haman. He doesn't feel like he needs to go to all those protocols. And so we have the king, of course, coming back just at that time. Coincidence? You got to remember, what is the author trying to show you every time he shows you coincidence? Then the king says, will you even assault the queen? Now, was he probably assaulting the queen?
That's the way they look at
right.
that.
Okay. Do you have any recollection of this ever happening before?
Yes.
Joseph.
Yeah.
With Joseph, right?
Right.
Joseph is almost in the same situation, and he gets thrown in prison for that. And that's why. Okay? It really doesn't matter about any sexual advancements or innuendos. Mm-hmm. It's the closeness. Mm-hmm. Because it could be that. And so as the word went out of the king's mouth, then they covered Haman's face. What does it mean to cover Haman's face? That's the punishment, by the way, for being, for coming close to the harem. What does that mean?
He's executed, or he's going to be executed.
No.
Separation.
Separation from whom?
Authority.
Which authority? Which authority right here?
The king.
He will not be in the king's presence anymore. He cannot see the king anymore.
Dead to me.
You see that? He can no longer be in the king's presence. That's covering Haman's face. That's what's happening there. This is not a death sentence. So things happen fast, and we want to put it all together. That's the punishment is you are no longer allowed in the court. You are no longer allowed in the king's presence. You will not see the king's face anymore. Okay? So then we have Harbona come in, one of the eunuchs, who says, oh, by the way, king, there's a gallows standing on Mordecai's property. And it's about Mordecai who spoke good to you. What does Harbona give the king in this? What?
The means to have Haman killed.
For what?
For the
treason. For treason.
Treason.
For treason. Mm-hmm. Okay. He says, obviously, Haman has been in cahoots with the plotting of the assassins, and he's trying to get rid of the man who's protecting you. And so Haman now can be hanged for treason. Do you see that?
Yep.
Treason against the king, not coming under the king's authority. And so Haman gets hanged on the king's wages. Now, here's one thing. How do you think Harbona knew about the gallows?
Maybe he helped him make it.
Well, Harbona? No, he's the king's servant, right?
There's because Haman had to make it this huge thing that everyone could
okay.
see.
Let's remember this. Esther didn't know about it because in the palace, in the court, they don't know much about that's going outside unless somebody tells them, mm-hmm. right? Harbona's in the court. But what we know is the king has had this sleepless night. He's found out about Mordecai the Jew. He's found out, oh, wait a second. Haman has been the one to decree this. What do you think the king would do?
Him go out and go to his house?
Go figure out what Haman's up
yeah,
to.
Yeah.
Go figure out what Haman's up to. Mm. And Harbona has, this is what Haman's up to. My guess is the king already knew this. But someone has to give him the means to kill him, not according to protocol. King still has to follow.
Well, and Haman's pride got in the way, because had he been plotting it but not made it so obvious, maybe yeah. he wouldn't have found it.
Well, he would have waited to build the gallows until
yeah.
after
yeah.
the edict was
I mean,
made.
Or not so tall or
yeah.
something.
So, what I want you to do, so now you kind of seen the intricacies underneath all of what's going on. I want you to look at the second page, or the third page probably. And remember I talked to you about chiastic structure, or chiasms? This is I'm showing you the chiasm that the author has written into the book of Esther, so that you understand what he's trying to say. So, we haven't gone through the two end banquets, but what you see is, we have Xerxes' banquet for the nobles, Xerxes' banquet for the servants, and Vashti's banquet go at the same time. We have third, the banquet celebrating Esther's coronation, and fourth, Esther's first banquet for the king and Haman. And then we have the mirrors of them on the other side. Do you see how they mirror each other? Mm-hmm. Esther's second banquet mirrors her first. The banquet celebrating Mordecai's promotion celebrates mm-hmm. Esther's coronation. The banquet in Susa and the provinces celebrate... reflects the banquet for the servants and Vashti's banquet. And then the banquet in Susa only reflects the banquet for the royals only. You see that? Do you see how cool that author just wrote that in so beautifully? What they do, the reason you write in with a chiasm is to point out the highlight. And the highlight is always the fulcrum. What has happened in the fulcrum? So that point in the middle between the two banquets, and they're back to back, there's going to only be a very short thing that happens. What happens in that space?
God. A reversal of
yeah.
fortune.
But you're right, God. Why do we know it's God?
There's always, we speak of them as coincidences.
Yes.
Those I can't all line up.
What's the specific coincidence in this fulcrum here? The king can't sleep. The king can't sleep. That's the highlight of the whole book. For the purpose of saying, God's directing this whole thing. God, only God can make a man sleep and not sleep. And that's why I said to you, Jen, let's make sense of why couldn't the king not sleep? The author specifically writes it so that there is no sense to it. We want to make sense to it because then we kind of have an idea of control, right? Well, there was a reason. It's not reasonable. In fact, it's so not reasonable because the king was drinking the night before, right?
And why that?
So he should be sleeping.
He's been 5 years. He's been worried for 5 years.
Right, right, right. So the way that the author structures the writing points to, do you understand what the coincidence is about? God's underneath all of this. God is directing all of this. So we see with the chiasm the rise and the fall of the plot, and we would think that the highlight of it would be one of the big pinnacle points, right? But it's just the ordinary, the king can't sleep. We see this sudden reversal, though, on the fact that the king couldn't sleep. That's where the reversal comes. So it comes at the behest of something underneath it all, that coincidence or that divine providence. So we see that the tipping point, and that's what we would call that there, is the tipping point, right? We see it seems to be insignificant, but it takes the focus away from the human activity, because all this activity going on, we could say, is because somebody did something. And it takes it away from the human decisions to God causing the things to happen. It reveals God at work there. So as much as you might not like figuring out literary structures and things, it's really important in a lot of the books. When you get to the Gospels, oh my, there's so much of it in the Gospels that you completely miss. And of course, we take things out and we want to interpret, you know, the parables, you know, on their own. But they're in the midst of chiasms a lot of the time, or other literary things. And you see that what the author's trying to do. So what we need to understand is the stream of history. How does that work? What we understand from Esther is that the stream of history moves forward by God's unseen hand. It's God who is directing the stream of history all the time. Because the stream of history has a specific goal. And because it's directed by God, it will end up where God purposes to end up. It's already decided. The stream has already been placed out. God is the one directing that. And it will accomplish covenant, which is exactly what's happening here. Is, remember, the best definition for covenant is covenant saves from death and equips for life. Covenant saves from death and equips for life. And that's what God is doing in the stream of history. He's making sure that covenant is being worked out. And it will be worked out. We also know from this that God mostly works through ordinary events in humanity. And that's good news to us. Because what that says is he's committed to partnering with human beings to make sure his covenant works out. He's committed to that. He committed to that in Genesis 1 and 2. You are my image bearers. And there was never a time where he said, boy, you're not doing a good job, that's done. We're done. He's committed to making sure that his image bearers are working with him to get covenant done. The stream of history is based on God's authoritative power, his kind of power, which is beyond human reason. It's not reasonable. This story shows that none of this was reasonable, that it should end up this way. It's just, it makes for a great story, doesn't it? We love stories like that, but it's not reasonable. We say, well, that was a story. In real life, things don't work out that way. What the book of Esther is saying is, yes, they do. They do. God has always making sure his covenant works out, and he's always going to bring us to the point of reversing the fortune of those who are in covenant. It's also consistent. It's consistent not with circumstances, but with God's word. What has God said? I will protect my covenant people. I will provide for my covenant people, even when it looks like I'm not. And I think this is one of those huge points about Esther is so many times we say, I don't get it. This is horrible. So I think some of you know that my sister's husband was diagnosed with cancer last year. He had his esophagus taken out. Everything was going great. Yesterday, he got the results that the cancer's back. Mm-hmm. And the first, your first question is, well, this isn't good, right? This isn't good. How can this be good? Where's God? What's God doing? Esther tells us God's working out covenant. Even when it looks like he's not. Even when it looks like he's not protecting my life. But what Esther is telling us is you've got to believe that it is God who has control of the stream of history. And if you're in covenant, you're his covenant partner, he is bringing you life. It may not look like what we think. And certainly for the Jews, they're not thinking that. And next week is really that show of, this is life? Really? Didn't think that that's what it would look like. It's consistent with his promises, despite sin or location or the power of the enemy. It's still going to work out, and it's still going to be what he has deigned to be. And it doesn't, covenant doesn't require miraculous intervention. This was, from every aspect, it looked very ordinary, and it looked like it just, whoa, that was weird. I mean, that's what we would say, right? Well, that was weird. Instead of saying, God's at work, he's doing covenant. And that's what Esther wants us, the book of Esther wants us to get to. It doesn't require miraculous intervention. And, you know, I began thinking about that. So why or when does God miraculously intervene? We need to understand, sometimes we think miraculous, the things that happen miraculous are this intervention of God coming from here and swooping in. But all of Scripture tells us God doesn't come from here and swoop in. God is here. Mm-hmm. So that when miraculous things happen, it's not an intervention. It's not this, like, I'm coming from here to get here and save you. And from what I could think through in Scripture, miracles happened when someone there already knew or was witnessing to the fact that God was here. That it was a miracle doesn't happen when everybody there thinks God's there. Do you see that?
Yes.
Because then that would affirm our idea that God swoops in, that God's not here.
I think he miraculously intervenes every day, like just being with us.
Okay, but the being with us and the intervention idea, we think of intervention as outside breaking through, coming from outside.
Okay.
Miracles happen when someone knows that God's here, not that he's there. Does that make sense?
Right, okay.
That he's with us.
Right.
And so when you think about, and because I'm going through the Gospels now and I'm reading through all these miracles, every time there's someone as a witness that God's right here. Usually it's Jesus, but a lot of times others. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So in history, when we think about that, and when I think about even today, there are miracles that happen. I mean, literally great, huge miracles. Where do they usually happen? Do you know?
Places.
Third world countries.
Third world countries. Yeah. Why do you think? If you know anything about third world countries, if you've lived in third world countries,
All they have is God.
Everything's spiritual,
right,
in third world countries. They know God is here. They know the divine is here. So I'm not surprised that miracles happen there and not here. Here, we live very much. God is there. We're here.
And we control our lives much more.
And we control our lives.
We can
handle
a lot
of it. Exactly. Exactly.
And we have so much money and things to care for stuff to a certain extent. You know, it's not like we have to pray that God will multiply the food at the dinner table.
Right, exactly.
We're distracted.
Yeah,
we're
exactly.
Distracted.
Yeah, yeah. But there's this idea that God needs us to understand he's here. And he's not going to bring a miracle if we don't think he's here. Does that make sense?
Well, or we're not going to see it.
We're not going to see it as a miracle, right?
We're not
no.
Here,
well,
but
no.
We might not recognize
right,
it.
Right.
The other reality is that in many third world countries, it is not like here where there is a proliferation of multiple different religions, where there's this religious freedom. In a lot of countries, there is a unifying religion for the most part. So here, it's easy to dismiss because there are constantly people around you that do not follow our Bible, and it is part of what we are socialized to accept. So for me, I feel like there's lots of opportunities to be convinced not to go with the word first, mm-hmm. because there's a lot of competing messages, whether it's from another religion or from other idols or from politics or wherever. So for me, it's like with more freedom comes more suffering in terms of following the word. Whereas when you're in a country where there isn't very much freedom and there is mostly a dominant religion, it's just what you do.
And I will tell you, in third world countries, the divine, no matter what religion you are, the divine is here.
Yes.
And everyone assumes that life is spiritual. And it's hard to understand what that's like unless you go live over there. I've not lived over in third world country, but both my kids have. And they both came back, walked into the United States and said, wow, everything's so separated from our spiritual here. Mm-hmm. I mean, literally they were here a day and that's how they felt.
Wow.
So mm-hmm. there's this overwhelming idea that the divine lives here. Mm-hmm. So lastly, the stream of history is not determined by humanity. We often say that event turned the wheels of history. In truth, that's not true. Mm-hmm. God has already made the stream of history go that way. What happens is that we get to choose whether we'll be in the stream of history or whether we want to be outside the stream of history of covenant being fulfilled. Covenant is being fulfilled in history. It's God's tool. It's not our tool. We get to be in it, and we get to make all sorts of streams coming out of it if we want and be our own self-rule. But his stream gives us the chance to join that or to not join that. We don't have to. He's a God who is very vulnerable. I'll give you your choice. We can go where history is. And kind of like Haman. Haman knows this prophecy. But he's going, oh no. I'm authority here. I'm stronger than this prophecy. What he's saying is, I don't have to go in the stream where it's going. It's going to fulfill covenant. I'm bigger than that. I can determine my own course of life. I'll go my own way. And what we see in Esther is the writer is saying, yeah, it doesn't actually work out that way. You have determined the way you want to go. It's going to be outside of covenant. It's going to be outside of where history is going, where everything is going. And that will be fulfillment of covenant. And that the life of those in covenant, those who have joined into the stream, will be protected. So here's a question I want to ask you as we wrap up. If you know that God is working out covenant in everything, in your own history and in big history, both things, protecting you from life or from death, equipping you for life, remembering that his definition of death, his definition of life is not being in his presence. Remember, we see Haman covering, can't be in his presence, because that's what he chose, right? He chose, I want to be the authority over you. And so he got what he chose. That's why the king waits for him to choose completely. If I know that, though, how is what I'm deciding today about, and I'll talk about those things, anything, how is that claiming protection as one of God's covenant partners? In other words, and I want you to choose one of these things this week, and I want you to think through, how am I deciding? Let's just choose the eating. How is my eating decisions claiming that I am in the covenant stream and I want God's covenant protection? Or is it doing the opposite? Is it saying, I'm my own authority, I don't need God's covenant protection here? Do you understand my question?
No.
Yep.
Some of you do, some of you don't. How else can I explain it?
Kind of a quick example. I'm not eating, if I snack too much before dinner, I'm not hungry. By the time dinner is made, then I'm not necessarily having a communal dinner with my family. I'm mm-hmm. like, I can't, like,
feel like it's not building life because I've chosen to eat before and I'm not joining my family.
So why did I decide what I wanted to eat when I wanted to eat it?
Because
I was hungry. But a covenant partner says, I'm upholding the honor of my covenant partner, right? I'm upholding his authority to say, this is good for you, this is not. It's good for you to be in community. It's good for you to, whatever the issue is, thinking through those decisions, why are you making the decision you're making? Is your first reason for making it is because it satisfies me? Because that's how Haman made
his
decision, right?
Start with the word I.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. I need this. And the real easy way to do this is to say, and literally I've tried this and it's horrible. You say, every time you make a choice, well, God, I'm going to have this snack because, and you talk to God about it. I'm going to have this, God, because. What does that do? Right.
Justifying everything you're doing.
Yeah. Does that make sense?
It does, but I got to just ask you people because you've not let me know this anytime recently. What in the Sam Hill does God want me to eat?
Okay, so those are the questions, right? Those are conversations we have with God, right? What does God say about my body? It's his temple. It's where he lives.
That's right? What I thought.
Yeah. So I want you to choose one of these things that you know probably is a little iffy in your life. That your decisions here are usually made on what your feelings about either the circumstances or your emotions. Are you Haman here? And if so, then just try this exercise for a couple days, asking God, saying to God, this is why I'm doing this. This is why I'm making this decision. If you have to explain it to God, it will reveal to you where the authority is. You're using your own authority, redefined. And I have done this. And sometimes I've outright said, okay, God, I'm going to have this. I know you don't want me to have it, but I'm going to have it because I feel bad. I have done that. Mm-hmm. And here's the thing. You do not enjoy what you get. You're like, Haman, I am going to do this. I am going to have this chocolate cupcake. I know, God, and you don't want, but I'm going to have this. It's not to say you can't ever have it, but you could ask, right? Hey, God, and I've done that too. God, would I be able to have this cupcake? He would love to give us our desires if it's good for us, if it's for life, right? Because he's about covenant. He wants to protect your life, save from death.
Maybe one cupcake.
Right. Okay. And that's very much, very well maybe what he says. What this does is begin you in conversation with God rather than, well, God, would you do this, 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 and this? But now you're in conversation. You're literally asking him, this is what I want to do, and this is why I want to do it. What do you think, God? I mean, it comes up really short.
So an example would be, you know, before you say something to your child about an issue or something, it's like, okay, this is what I want to say right now.
And yep, and this is why I want to say it, God. You always have to give him the reason, because that just reveals, oh, that's why I want to do that. So that's my challenge for you this week, is take one of those things, and I want to hear what happened this week with this. And remember that he doesn't think suffering is a bad thing. In protecting your life, he doesn't. And we're actually going to learn something about that next week, how the Jewish Midrash looks at Esther and sees the difference between suffering and life. So, Father, thank you that you give us such real life, applicable stuff in your word. Thank you that you reveal to us that you're always making sure the covenant works out, that you are looking to save us from death, from being not in your presence, and to equip us for life, equip us for living with right authority under your authority. You are so good, God. May we remember that this week. In Jesus' name, amen.